Cell phones, satellite TV, and myriad other technology make living in the country easier these days, but they also make it less country. This hour, a discussion with people trying to preserve rural life in Ohio and around the globe. Good morning and welcome to All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann one more day. And this day, today, we're focusing on rural sustainability. Dewey Thorbeck is director of the Center for Rural Design at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Mr. Thorbeck.
Well, thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
And I'm evidently all thumbs this morning. We're supposed to be joined by Kenyon College's Rural Life Center Director, Howard Sachs. I accidentally just hung up on Howard, so we'll try to get him back on the line as soon as we can. So the Center for Rural Design, Dewey Thorbeck, what exactly is that?
Well, about 15 years ago, I after teaching design in the College of Design, architectural design. I'm an architect, and I'm also an architect in private practice. And just through a combination of things, I started to realize that the design professions and the design schools had fundamentally ignored rural America, and that there was a thing called urban design, but nowhere was anyone teaching a course or a curriculum program in rural design. So in 1957, I approached the deans of the College of Design and College of Food, Ag, Natural Resources, Sciences at the University of Minnesota about starting a center for rural design, and they gave me my blessings, and off I went. So I have two deans to report to, but other than that, I'm free to kind of tackle any rural issue we can. So that's how it came about.
I think a lot of people hear the term rural design, and they might think of Mother Nature. But what is urban designing? What do you need to do? What do you do as opposed to urban design?
Well, urban design is really fundamentally the kind of the shaping of public space, and so that buildings are helped to define that space, and so it's all related to the public realm. Whereas in rural design, we're really talking about large landscapes where buildings and even small towns are objects in that larger landscape. And so the scale is quite different. The issues can be very complex because we're talking about food and environmental issues. And when we talk about a rural community, that could have many different definitions too. And but that's really the basic difference. It's the scale and the connection to the landscape and how one thinks of place.
And I think we do have Howard on the line now. Howard, are you with us?
Good morning.
And my apologies for hanging up on you. Again, Howard Sachs, the director of Kenyon College's Rural Life Center. Tell us about your center, Howard. What exactly is it that you do?
Well, the Rural Life Center is designed to provide educational, scholarly, and public projects to help ensure the vitality of rural Knox County in the face of a changing society. It's really a strong collaboration between Kenyon College and the surrounding rural community, hopefully to promote the educational mission of the college and address the needs and interests of the surrounding rural community.
We want to hear from listeners as well. Are you concerned about decreasing countryside, fewer farmers, even a faster pace of life? Call 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. You can also email the program allsigns@wosu.org, post a note to our Facebook page, or you can tweet the show at WOSU All Signs. And again, Howard Sachs from the Rural Life Center. Rural life is vastly different than it was even just a couple decades ago. Kind of set the table for us. How different is rural life compared to just a few years ago?
Well, I think it's different in several respects. And one of the places that I usually start in trying to talk about this is to define exactly what we mean by rural or rural character. And I think it has a number of dimensions. One is just the ecology of the place. Rural communities are historically defined by green space, a certain lay of the land, pastures. In Knox County, pastures and cropland punctuated by farmhouses and small self-sustaining villages. A second dimension of rural character is the primacy of agriculture, especially small-scale family farming as the economic engine of these communities. There's a particular kind of social life to rural communities, too, one that's based on personal familiarity, one that has a very rich public life. And then finally, rural communities are characterized by a certain set of cultural values: neighborliness, stewardship, mm-hmm. hard work, independence. And so these are the things that define rural character, and these are the elements that have been changing. In many cases, for example, in Knox County, exurban sprawl has done a lot to change the face of the green space and the ecology as farmland is being sold off to provide opportunities for housing developments or what we call McMansions out in Knox County. Agriculture is facing real severe challenges in the face of an increasingly global and corporate kind of agribusiness, as people find themselves having to drive further to get jobs, employment, maybe commuting to Columbus or other towns where they would not have in previous generations. There's less time for social life, less opportunities to get together. And the other change that's really significant is growing cultural diversity. Here in Knox County in the last 15 years, a significant influx of Old Order Amish. A lot of rural communities have Hispanic communities, and how we deal with that is another issue that speaks to a significant change.
And you wrote in a paper titled, Why Are There Not Any Turkeys at the Danville Turkey Festival? You really set this up. You really did a good job of portraying this conflict. I'm reading from your paper here. Sitting on the front porch of my farmhouse at night, I'm surrounded by absolute silence, save the occasional sound of nature, and absolute darkness, save the heavenly bodies in the evening sky. But you go on to write, but along the next road west of my place, the fields have been split into 5-acre lots, and the lights from modular homes and starter mansions now obscure the stars at night. The new inhabitants don't think much of the scent of farm life or the way machinery runs day and night at harvest time. And so there is this kind of culture clash that didn't exist even just a few years ago.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. One of the real challenges is the relationship between newcomers who may see Knox County as a sort of bedroom community. And, you know, there's an odd thing I've noticed with respect to new developments is that the name of developments are always named for whatever they eliminate, you know. So you get Fox Run or Pretty Creek or whatever, and that really is exactly what they've destroyed in creating the development. And they tend not to see and understand the community the way the people who have been here for many generations have, and the newcomers tend to see the old-timers as standoffish. So how do you create that dialogue that ensures the vitality of the community? Because these seemingly insignificant conflicts really come to the fore when you start talking about, are we going to have a levy, you know, to support our schools or to support the fire department? And those cleavages, you know, create fundamental political cleavages that make it difficult for communities to move forward.
Yeah, and my coworker Sam Hendren recently did a piece on ag tourism, which I think previous generations might be kind of puzzled by that term, ag tourism, but that is that kind of shows where we're at as far as the decreasing agriculture community in and around central Ohio and the nation as a whole, that people will flock to these areas where agriculture still does exist. Dewey Thorbeck, let's bring you back into this discussion. 100 years ago, people hauled water, rode their horse to town, churned their own butter. None of that really happens anymore. And you're trying to at least save some of the design elements of that. How do you incorporate, what exactly do you do as far as design to preserve culture?
Well, when you think about design, you have to think of it in its very broad characteristics. Design is fundamentally a problem-solving process. And it is a way to kind of engage citizens who live in a rural area or an urban area from that standpoint into the process of kind of trying to envision what their future should be like or can be like. And so it's a matter of kind of defining with the citizens the values that they place on the landscape within which they live, and then to develop kind of alternatives through geospatial kind of ideas so that the citizens themselves can kind of determine their future direction. And you're quite right. Howard, I think, did a very excellent job of kind of explaining some of the changes and issues that are going on and in rural areas. And it's not only just the population kind of shift, but we also have tremendous changes, particularly since 1960, in the kind of nature of farming. In the United States, and really in many respects around the world, there's been a very, very strong desire for cheap food. And so agriculture and farmers have reacted to that to try to find better and ways to kind of produce more food at less cost. And mm-hmm. so we have problems that vary a great deal around the country. For instance, you can drive through Iowa and Nebraska and some parts of Minnesota, and you see nothing but corn. And so this monocultural farming, even though it produces a heck of a lot of corn, it also has a tremendous economic potential problem if there's some kind of a blight or something like that that were to impact that corn, just like the potato famine in Ireland many years ago.
Is this just a natural evolution? Are people who are opposing this kind of, do they have their head in the sand at all? Is this just a natural evolution?
Well, I think economics drives a lot of decisions on the part of farmers, and I would say the farmers that I know are trying to be very sustainable in what they do, but often it's a matter of just simply the economics as to where they have to go. For instance, we have in Minnesota, one of our largest dairy farms has 5,000 cows under one building and one roof, with about 50 people working in that building 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. 7 days a week. And so the scale is tremendous. I think it's a very well-run farm, and they recycled everything to create their own energy, and it's a very well. But that's a different kind of relationship and connection with the land than it used to be with a family farm with 30 cows, for instance. And so even though farmers, I think, really want to do what's right, the economics sometimes don't allow it. And at the same time, those that are entrepreneurial, and there's farmers that are entrepreneurs just like anyone else, they adjust to the economy and act accordingly.
Well, I really want to delve into farming in the next segment. I'd like to stick to culture as much as we can in mm-hmm. this segment. Howard Sachs, back to you. Is rural life really just a novelty anymore? We do have farmers, of course, but a lot of people who live in the country really only do so because they want to. It's not because they need to.
Well, those people who are, you know, born in these rural communities and raised in them have a strong, longstanding commitment that they find very significant. So, you know, we in a modern urbanized cosmopolitan society see the choice of where we live as being very much an individual choice. We live in a world which is socially mobile, which is geographically mobile, and we think nothing of moving every 4 or 5 years to go to another place. And it really has very little to do with our connection to place, the sense of culture, the sense of our relationship to the land and the other. That's a very different case for people who grow up in a rural community. For them, this connection to place and the culture and kind of sociability that relates to it is really fundamental to their sense of who they are and the like. So it's, while of course it is at some level a choice, and in some cases young people do choose to move away, it's one that's very significant. And I think it's important because of that, because it provides a lesson or a point of perspective for the rest of us. That is to say, these people in rural communities, and I would count myself among them, who receives a very profound sense of meaning and identity and connection to place from that kind of experience, really stands in sharp contrast to the folks who are always moving around and living the kind of existence that we associate with modern urban society. And we can ask, is that a good thing, what we do today, you know, that we move around and we follow our career and we do so without any connection to something broader than ourselves? So I think there's a lesson to be learned from engaging with rural society. It's not only an issue for rural people, but I think it's an issue for everybody. One of the reasons that we are in this series of events we're having next week at Kenyon College on rural sustainability, our keynote speaker is an Amish bishop and a lifelong farmer, and we're bringing him to provide an Amish perspective on sustainability, partly because he does bring that different sensibility about land and culture mm-hmm. and our relation to it.
Listeners, give us a call. Have you moved out of the city into the country, or maybe vice versa? How has it changed you? Have you enjoyed the experience? Do you regret it? Do you wish you lived in the country still? Again, vice versa. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. And we're going to go to break right now, but when we return, I want to really dive into how all of this affects farming and land use. That's just ahead here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at wosu.org/allsides.
It's been an action-packed week for the Supreme Court as the nine justices held hearings on California's Prop 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. While we wait for rulings, we wonder what we learned and where does the fight go from here? I'm Celeste Headlee. NPR's Nina Totenberg explains the legal arguments, plus human cannonball Ileana Grace. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4. And thanks for joining us today. Sunny skies, a high near 48 degrees. Partly cloudy for tonight and a low of 30. More sunshine and a high near 50 on Friday. Support comes from Clintonville Academy, pre-kindergarten through 8th grades. Clintonville Academy now participates in the Ed Choice Scholarship Program and is accepting applications until April 12th. More information is online at clintonvilleacademy.org. Small school, smart choices. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about rural life, the countryside, farming, wide open spaces, what it means to be country folk in 2013. We're joined by Howard Sachs from Kenyon College's Rural Life Center, which has a week of rural life events planned for next week. We can delve into that more here in a little bit. We're also joined by Dewey Thorbeck from the University of Minnesota's Center for Rural Design. It's the first and only center of its kind in the world. Dewey Thorbeck, you write that by 2050, there may be another 2.5 billion people, and the U.S. will have another 100 million. How will all of this affect farming and the world food supply?
Well, that's a big question, and it's a global issue, and we're all actually being impacted by the global economy and the global impacts on technology and politics and everything else. So this is something that, and farming is no different. I mean, it's being impacted by that, and I've read the projection for Ohio. I think you're going to have another 1.1 million people. Mm-hmm. Minnesota, we're going to have 900,000. So the question is, where are these people going to live? Where are they going to work? How are they going to have recreation? And at the same time, where is the food going to come from, the fuel, and how do we deal with water? And then kind of an overriding thing, which I think has a lot of merit is in terms of how to think about this, is this notion of connecting human, animal, and environmental health as one integrated idea. So, and as I've been talking with people in Minnesota and rural areas, I think this is really catching on. It's a way to kind of help link urban people with rural people, because you can't solve a rural problem without also simultaneously thinking about the rural issue and vice versa. And that's what rural design is trying to do.
We do have a caller on the air, Toby from Delaware. Toby, good morning.
Good morning there.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
I grew up in Danville, actually.
Oh, there you go.
So when you mentioned the Turkey Festival, it kind of hit home there. I kind of took a little exception to the whole rural idea, just because I am 37, so I'm kind of I'm the middle generation between the author and myself, and I didn't grow up. I love Danville. I love it there. It's a wonderful place to be. My dad's buried there. My grandmother's buried there. It's my home, but to make the living I wanted to live, I had to move out of Danville. I live in Delaware. I work in Delaware. My friends, you know, a lot of my Danville friends live in Columbus because that's mm-hmm. where they had to go to get jobs. You know, it's not about not wanting to be rural. It's about taking that rural sense of who we are. We took the rural person and we moved to the city. It's not being, and I'm not trying to say, I took a little exception to that idea that because we moved to the city, it made a, we abandoned it.
Yeah, Toby, I should say I'm also from Northern Union County, really in the middle of nowhere. I now live in Columbus, and I'm planning to buy a house back in my hometown later this week, maybe next week. But I see exactly what you're saying. You can balance. It doesn't have to be one or the other. I guess I would ask: have you incorporated any aspects of your rural roots into your living in Delaware?
Yeah. I mean, we do it. My wife is also from. She's from Seneca County. So we went as country or as rural as you could get, I guess. She's from 100-some acre farm. So basically we have, raised beds. We live in a development. So, we got raised beds, but we also were looking to get some land outside of town to do some more agriculture, some more farming. But also on top of that, we get out of town as much as possible. We have kayaks, or we're trying to do stuff to get out of here and get back into nature, and give back and do that kind of stuff. We, and the little things that you see in the rural community where you talk about the social aspect, we're making those connections one-on-one below the surface and doing little things that nobody knows about to help people one-on-one that you would see, you don't see, I don't have to say it exactly, but I knew people that were hungry in Danville, but you never saw them. You never saw them go hungry, because somebody always dropped off a bag of groceries.
And it wasn't in the forefront of the community. There weren't
exactly.
there weren't soup kitchens or food pantries.
Yeah, because somebody always took care of it. It just never got mentioned. It's just somewhere somebody said something and somebody dropped it off, and it just happened.
Yeah.
And that's we're trying to spread stuff like that. Opening, doors to people here, because still Delaware itself still has enough rural people living around it that we can open some doors like that, and we're trying to do some things like that through Delaware.
Well, Toby, we do have to move on, but thanks so much for your call.
No problem. Thank you.
Back to Howard Sachs from the Rural Life Center at Kenyon College. Toby sounds like someone who probably didn't exist 100, 200 years ago, kind of this hybrid rural and urban resident.
Yeah, and Toby makes a really good point. I think there's a tendency to create a radical separation between ideas of rural and ideas of urban, and the connection, that interface, is really profoundly important, as Dewey mentioned, in terms of agriculture and the vitality of both those communities, but it also happens at the level of personality and consciousness, and I think Toby's a good example, and to some extent I'm a good example in the opposite direction. I grew up in Philadelphia, and I still bring a certain urban cosmopolitan sensibility to the way I live my life, but it's now informed and infused with this rural experience too. But in order to do that, Toby's experience and what he brings to Delaware assumes that there is a continued viability of that rural sensibility back in Danville, because if there wasn't, he wouldn't have that to bring. And the crisis that's facing a lot of rural communities is that that's disappearing. And you can look at places like Delaware and New Albany and other communities in and around Columbus that used to be small rural communities, crossroads villages, that have been absolutely transformed. And so it's harder and harder to find any of that rural character in those areas. So the challenge to rural communities is, how do you maintain that viability so that you can continue to have that kind of worldview and sensibility as part of Ohio?
And again, with the advent of the internet, cell phones, satellite TV, can you maintain that culture, or is it just going to be more and more homogenous?
Well, it's clearly different. But these sorts of things are not new to 2013. When the railroad came through Central Ohio in the 1850s and the 1860s, that brought an engagement with a national popular culture that didn't exist before, because now stores could have items, whether it was music and expressive culture or the latest fashion or news or anything else. The same thing happened with records and the radio at the turn of the 20th century, and so on and so forth. So rural communities have never existed in total isolation from the rest of the world, but each new kind of interaction with urban or metropolitan America creates new kinds of challenges. And today, as Dewey points out, that global agricultural system is a really paramount reality.
I do want to delve more into farming. We've been talking a lot about culture and rural life. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about rural life and rural sustainability. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. You can also email the program, allsides@wosu.org, and you can also tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. And we do have another call about farming. Joe from Westerville. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
You asked a great question earlier about, you know, another 2 billion people in the world, 100 billion in America. You also made a statement about monocrop farming. We're going to be using almost 5 billion bushels of corn for ethanol this year, 13 billion gallons mandated blending. Next year it goes to 14 billion. But the government is mandating that monocrop farming. And, you know, basically you're concerned about feeding that many more people, but we're converting that much food into fuel. How is that going to be addressed?
Howard or Dewey, can you tackle that question?
Certainly, tell you that there is a quite a lot of disconnect that is going on with that issue, because so many things regarding the rural areas is shaped by the economy and economic ideas. This shift, and of course, in the case of fuel, was to try to nurture ourselves away from fossil fuels to fuels that come from plants and things like that. But the other consequences of the ethanol is that a lot of the products we're finding now, for instance, that some of the byproduct that comes out of that process, which is used as animal feed, has caused some problems with the manure. Now that's a strange thing. No, it's not for sure yet. But there's been swine barns where the manure goes down through slats in the floor where a methane foam has built up, and there's been explosions, and they think it might be having to do with the food source that comes out of that ethanol deal. There's problems that need to be addressed, and that's what I think design is trying to do, but there's also a tradition of government support for all kinds of things that has really been a long-time tradition in this country.
Another major issue is, especially here in Central Ohio. Joe, thanks so much for the call. Another issue here in Central Ohio is the price of farmland has been skyrocketing in recent years, and that's also posing problems and questions about the future of the next generation of farmers. I guess, Howard Sachs, we can go back to you. How much of an issue is the price of land for the future of farming?
Well, I think it's a significant issue in a number of ways. For older farmers, who, as the saying goes, are oftentimes land rich and money poor. That is to say, they haven't been able to put money away for retirement. The average age of a farmer in Knox County now is 58 years old. And when you get pressures, particularly for ex-urban development, a developer will come along and offer to the farmer's perspective, a high price for that land because the development value is higher than the ag use value. And so the farmer, whose kids may have moved off to Delaware because there isn't a good job in the area and they don't want to continue farming, they may be very prompted by those high farm prices to say, you know, there's our retirement, Ma, let's move into town. And what that means is that we have fewer and fewer acres of farmland. And as Dewey has indicated, that's going to be necessary to feed more and more people. On the other end, if you have a young farmer who's 20 or 21 and wants to start out in farming, it becomes prohibitive because the cost of land added to the cost of machinery and everything else means that it might cost $500,000 just to get started in farming. And there aren't too many 20 or 21-year-olds who have that kind of money. So if you're not fortunate enough to inherit your parents' farm, it means that there are fewer and fewer farmers who can afford to get into the business.
Was this offset at all by the collapse of the housing market? My colleague Mandy Trumbull reported a few months ago that the housing collapse was a huge boon for farmers and helped them scoop up cheaper land that was being pawned off by developers.
Well, I can just jump in on that.
Sure.
One. It varies a great deal around the country, but the desire and the ability to sell houses to people that couldn't afford it. Had a lot of development that kind of leapfrogged out of urban areas and even suburban areas even further out, so that as Howard earlier indicated about houses being built in 5-acre lots, which is a terrible waste of the land. And now a lot of places, those houses are now going into foreclosure because the people simply couldn't afford it. So in some respects, this economic downturn in the housing market has been a good thing, I think, just to put a pause to some of this craziness. And we really need to, as a nation and as a state and even as regions, try to rethink what is the relationship between urban and rural. I know some areas have been doing, and I really think this is a terrific idea, is developing ag preservation land, where farmers are compensated for not selling their land for housing development and to keep it into an agricultural kind of thing. And that, I think as time goes on with more and more people the distant factor in terms of distributing food and all of these things, we really need to have a very distinct distinction between what is urban and what is rural. I don't really like the notion of suburb, not because it's a bad thing, but I think that suburb is actually urban, that there is no such thing as suburban. It's either urban or it's rural.
That's interesting.
And in Ohio, I don't know your state well enough. I've been there. Actually, I stayed overnight at Holmes County, which is a beautiful area. I like everything I've seen. I'm looking forward to a visit out there now. But Ohio, it may have its own kind of issues that it has to respond to. And one of the things I'll be talking when I'm there is about trying to establish regional thinking so that we don't, many of the ideas of townships and counties in the United States developed back in the 1785, when the land survey system went through the country, and those political boundaries are kind of sometimes hindrances. We need to try to find ways to cross boundaries, just as watersheds do, to find new ways to rethink what urban or rural is and what its relationship.
Yeah, Steve, if I may jump in here just to talk about Ohio in particular. Do I have a minute to do that?
I'd like to get to a caller real quick. That's okay. Mike's been waiting on the line for quite a while. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. I can't help thinking while listening to all this of the dichotomy between trying to keep the old-timey ways, the positive values, say, of the rural, and yet melding it with the contemporary technology. I'm reminded of the old television series, The Wild Wild West, which, even though it took place, if you remember it, in the Old West, they still had these incredibly advanced machines and equipment behind the paneled walls. And I can't help but thinking that the technology is helping us to do that. When you have, you have this whole local foods thing, but the farmer now very likely might have a laptop with GPS capabilities in his John Deere at this point. And it's an interesting blend to me. I think the technology really can help us to maintain, to go back or maintain some of the real values, the positive values from the rural lifestyle. And I'm curious if your guests want to comment on that.
Howard, would you like to take
a
quick shot at that?
If I may. And the image I have is not of the TV show, but of the movie Back to the Future. One of the things that we've been working very hard here in Knox County to do over the past 12 or 13 years is to develop a sustainable local food system to provide a dependable alternative economy for farmers that have difficulty competing on the global market. And a part of that is accomplished through technology. For example, we're now in the process of creating a web platform that is GPS-linked. That would provide an avenue for local farmers not only to advertise and let people know about the foods that they have available for sale, but to create a system that would enable institutional buyers, not only in Knox County but as far away from Columbus, of purchasing items from them and developing a new kind of purchasing and distribution system using the Internet that would enable us to reconstruct the kind of local and regional infrastructure for a regionally based food system that has really disappeared from the landscape but used to exist before World War II. Mm-hmm. So I think the point the caller makes is a really good one. How can we reconstruct that kind of regional food system, but do so in a way that reflects new technologies in the 21st century?
We're going to talk a lot about that regional food distribution right after the break. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in, and you're listening here on All Sides, or you're listening on 89.7 NPR News, and we're also streaming at WOSU.org/AllSides.
Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris have known each other for almost 40 years. He was in her band in the mid-70s, but they've just made their first full album as a duo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them and hear their music. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of the state of the modern midwife in Ohio and across the country. And then it's the latest in arts and culture with host Christopher Purdy. That's All Sides and All Sides Weekend tomorrow from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. Sunshine for today will reach a high near 48 degrees, partly cloudy tonight with a low of 30. Mostly sunny for Friday, back up to a high near 50. And a nice weekend, too, sunny on Saturday with a high of 55. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann again today. And we're talking rural life, rural sustainability. We've been joined for the entire hour by Howard Sachs from Kenyon College's Rural Life Center, which has a week of rural life events scheduled for next week. Also on the line still, Dewey Thorbeck from the University of Minnesota Center for Rural Design. Here in studio now is Jeff Sharp. He's a professor of environment and natural resources. He's also involved in the Social Responsibility Initiative at Ohio State. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you.
What is the Social Responsibility Initiative?
Well, a number of years ago in our college, we increasingly recognized that the problems facing our society, there might be an ecological or a production aspect of it in terms of producing food or how we interface with the environment. There's an economic one. But there's also a social dimension of this, how we go about doing it, how people are treated in it, what attitudes of society toward the productive use of the landscape. So we started this initiative to sort of highlight those kind of concerns. And we've been monitoring Ohioans' attitudes and views of agriculture and the food system and rural-urban interface life and these kind of topics for about a decade now.
I was reading a paper from the initiative that you were involved in. It says nearly 90% of all food for home consumption is now acquired from retail venues. So as far as getting to local food distribution, a great way to increase this isn't necessarily for small farmers to sell directly to consumers, but a better way would be for local farmers to get their products into the bigger stores.
Right. So when we think about the opportunities that exist in agriculture, of course, we have the dominant system that has a lot of commodity agriculture and corn, and it goes into a livestock system primarily. But there are a lot of opportunities for increasing number of opportunities for smaller producers in particular to engage in an alternative system of producing for direct markets. And a lot of times we focus in on farmers market opportunities or selling directly to consumers. But as we see sort of enthusiasm for this whole phenomena grow, there's a lot of opportunities to sort of direct that production not just to the farmers market, but to seeing it in our grocery stores. So maybe our Giant Eagles, our Kroger's, our regional Buellers, our regional grocery stores could actually sell that. And that requires a system that's open to those smaller scale farmers to access those markets. And we're starting to see some progress there in terms of distribution opportunities and trying to scale up the amount of food that's locally produced that's available in those stores.
But those opportunities have not been there?
Well, the system has evolved in a lot of different ways. So some folks have managed to continue to sell to, let's say, a restaurant. But as a Kroger or a Giant Eagle grows, they require a system that somebody can literally fill a truck, or the scale is much bigger. So it becomes harder for a smaller producer to access those kinds of markets. But interestingly, in some of our research, we've uncovered, a number of different sort of entities out there that could maybe, with proper incentives or encouragement, could actually start sourcing some of that that food locally and making it more available and working with smaller quantities.
What are the incentives?
Oh, in terms of just making known some of the relationships. I mean, it's partly facilitating the connections. So, sometimes the costs of developing a relationship with a, let's say, 10 small farmers is very high. So let's create systems by which those farmers aggregate. So we're starting to see kind of the idea of food hubs. Maybe they're places where the distributors can meet up with the producers in a venue where they get lots of product available at the same time. So in terms of incentive, it reduces the transaction costs of having to have a relationship with 20 different farmers, and it allows it like a single relationship in one site.
Howard or Dewey, back to either of you. Has this barrier for local farmers getting their products into the major stores, has that been a reason for a decline in rural life, a decline in farming?
Well, no, I think actually it's really helped both help the connections between urban and rural people. Farmers' markets are a tremendous gathering place, and in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities here, actually, if it weren't for the immigrants, particularly the Hmongs and the Vietnamese that came in a number of years ago, I don't think our farmers' markets would be anywhere near as vital as they are right now. And as Jeff has talked about, the growing concern for local food and the whole notion of wellness, just like there's a lot of trails being built. Urban agriculture is a rapidly growing thing, and so it's, I think, opening up broader ways for people to understand the connections between urban and rural, and so I think it's a very positive thing.
Howard, how has it played out up there in Knox and Holmes County, just north of us here in Columbus?
Well, as Jeff notes, there are all kinds of distinctive infrastructure problems that are required to make this kind of transformation. But we've been rather successful, at least in small ways, of doing that. Here at Kenyon College, to give but one example, our dining service feeds 2,500 meals a day. And so they need larger quantities of food, so on and so forth, and they need them the varieties that they need, and they need them at the time that they need them to prepare the food. And we had, in the beginning, a great number of challenges in order to identify producers, to coordinate that production, to deal with everything from the financial aspects of billing to getting the varieties that we needed and having the food at the time of year that we needed to do it. But to make a long story short, Kenyon College is now about 45% purchasing local food from the immediate area. And having created some of that infrastructure, now the public schools are starting to do it, senior citizen centers are starting to do it, the hospitals are starting to do it. And as you get more institutional buyers, that creates an incentive and opportunities for farmers to step up to the plate and produce more of what is needed and for us to build the infrastructure in between. The other thing I wanted to say really quickly is that Ohio is a really unique state, I think, in terms of the opportunities for these links between urban and rural. We have more urban metropolitan areas in this state than any other state in the union, and yet all of those metropolitan areas are surrounded by really active, vital agricultural production. So there's a real possibility here to create regional kinds of markets in which the surrounding rural area feeds the people in the cities. And I think that has all kind of opportunities, economic opportunities for the better quality food for the consumers, providing food to food deserts in the urban core. So I think Ohio is a really prime place to do this sort of new agriculture.
Yeah, that's a good point. You can be from downtown Columbus out in the country within just a few minutes. Bob is calling from Westerville. Bob, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a green identity business card here. It says I am a localist. then it has a URL for a group that Jeff is familiar with and I'm a member of. And the other side simply lists what the organization that has the URL does. I wonder if they, if your group would comment on the relationship between I'm a Localist and Buckminster Fuller State Evolution, Think Globally, Act Locally.
Jeff Sharp from Ohio State, can you comment on Bob's being a Localist?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really gets back to this idea of sustainability. I think as we confront some of the challenges of the future, particularly climate change, if to the extent it sort of impacts it, we're going to have a real strong need to be resilient. And I think that's going to require us to have both global connections and local. And I think one of the concerns that people have expressed is we've allowed ourselves to become detached from the local. I mean, the productive landscape around us, it's interesting that it does not produce food that we consume, or at least it indirectly eventually gets there, but it doesn't produce it directly. And we might need to have more resilience and sort of a greater reliance and appreciation for the local to support our biosystem, our food system. And I think it requires us then to sort of think about how do we develop a system that is resilient. It's we can get food locally, and then if we have disaster locally, we can get food globally, because it's like we can't sort of expect to be completely local, but we have to have this sort of intersection between local and global. And I think the goal of local food system development in part is to create a resilient local system that goes with the global.
So not a complete turn away from quote monocropping, but just incorporating the traditional farmer, the guy who had maybe the guy who had chickens and grew corn and two or three other crops, a really well-rounded farmer, quote unquote, but incorporate that along with monocropping.
Mm-hmm.
Howard or Dewey, any comments there as far as trying to meet this balance between monocropping and then having a diverse food supply?
Well, I would, you know, Buckminster Fuller talked about the global and local connections. I would add to that, really, we have to think globally and locally and act simultaneously, because all of these things are interconnected, and there is a growing concern and interest in wellness and trying to keep our humans and our animals and our environment well, and so this. Food is one of those things that is kind of common to all of those aspects. And so if you can, the more people can kind of make the connections as to where their food comes from and the quality of it and the kind of recipes, which are, of course, ethnically connected, which is, I mean, Richard Florida talks about the creative and the diversity of places. Those places that will succeed in the future are those that are most diverse and catered a wide range of interest. And so food is one of those wonderful things that just varies a great deal around the world. And the more we understand it, the more I think we get to know each other better and kind of recognize we're all on this same planet. Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
It always comes back to food. Brian from Columbus, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I may have missed a little bit going from the car to the office here, but there was some discussion. Jeff was talking about food hubs and local distribution networks, but then there was also the comment about farmers markets and community gardens. And really, I think we're at the stage now where instead of farmers markets and community gardens, we need to talk about slaughterhouses and trucks. We need to really look at that processing and distribution infrastructure, and that's what we need to enable the local food system go from a niche market to a mainstream market. And I guess I'd like to hear some thoughts and comments from the guests.
Jeff?
This is the challenge. It's we've created a system that has gone in one direction, and now there's a lot of excitement for creating some new opportunities. For example, we do try to support the buying of local chickens and pork in our household, and it's sometimes hard to make those connections, and part of it's there aren't that many locker facilities. I grew up in a rural place on a farm, and you used to have every town had a small locker, so it was very mm-hmm. easy to access that kind of thing. Now it's very challenging, but what Brian's referring to there is we have this infrastructure, these processors, these things need to be invented. offended. The exciting thing about Ohio is we have a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of creativity, and there's a lot of things happening. I see it on the milk side. I go to my Giant Eagle, and I see Hartzler's Dairy Milk and Snowville Creamier Milk in the milk section. And these are both local businesses that have scaled up, and they're starting to develop sort of capacity to deliver in large quantities. And I think we need to see that evolve into other areas. But with the urban markets we have here, food entrepreneurs have a lot of opportunities that they can figure out how to make it work. And that's the exciting thing about Ohio in this regard.
You know, I just let me, Jeff, build on what you just said. That word entrepreneurship is absolutely a critical thing.
Absolutely. Excuse me. Little interference there with the phone lines. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown filling in for Ann, and we're talking about rural life, rural sustainability, food sustainability. 614-292-8513 to join the discussion. We do have an email from Job. How to feed the 2 billion new mouths in the future? My answer to that question is to promote urban gardening, something Jeff touched on, using containers. In 1993, I set up a vegetable garden on the roof of a garage in Chicago. I used wading pools as containers and grew vegetables. We must consider converting the urban wasteland into gardens. That's something that's very popular in Columbus and other cities around the country. Abandoned factories becoming full-scale industrial farms. The growth of urban farming, how much has that weighed in the decline or the comeback of rural life?
Right. Well,
Jeff Sharp.
Go ahead.
Dewey or Howard, whoever would like to jump in.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think it's necessarily, competing with rural farmers to a significant extent. But what it does point out to is the need for a diversified approach. I think one of the problems with the emergence of global monoculture, in the past 40 or 50 years, is that it has suggested that one size fits all, that there's one solution to provide food for everybody on the planet. And I think what we're seeing in the emphasis on local, on regional, on urban gardens and the like, is that there are a diversity of approaches that are available to producing our food, and that different approaches work best in different kinds of environmental niches, and we need to take all of them seriously and see how they fit into an overall sustainable food system.
Go ahead, Dewey.
Yeah, well, I was just going to add, I think this urban agriculture is just at the early stages of trying to define what it is, and I think it is a very, very exciting opportunity, particularly for entrepreneurs. I just read something that, India, as a country, produces more milk than any other nation in the world, and that there's a whole slug, maybe Jeff knows this better than I do, there's a whole number of those are urban farms, where they have cattle and pigs and chickens, and they grow vegetables and everything right in amongst where everybody lives.
Yeah, we have an urban farm store now in Columbus, City Folks Farm Shop on High Street.
Yeah, well, I think, my next thing is I think maybe we need more backyard goats and chickens, and so that the animal side of this whole issue is brought in as well as the vegetable side.
Well, I'm not sure. I think some city zoning commissions might disagree with you, but I'm not here to argue with you about that at all. Howard Sachs is Kenyon College's. He directs the Rural Life Center there, which has a host of events there planned for next week. Dewey Thorbeck is the director of the Center for Rural Design at the University of Minnesota. And Jeff Sharp is from Ohio State University's Social Responsibility Initiative. Thanks to all of you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown. Stay tuned. Coming up tomorrow, a discussion about modern midwifery. And also Christopher Purdy and his guests tell us about the latest in arts and culture on All Sides Weekend. That's coming up tomorrow on All Sides. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. And streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.